From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, and this week our critics review Disney's live-action musical comedy Aladdin, starring Will Smith as the genie, Guy Ritchie, the director and co-screenwriter. The comedy Booksmart stars Kathleen Dever and Beanie Feldstein, and we'll also hear about the documentary on L.A.'s Laurel Canyon, Echo in the Canyon. It all comes your way this hour on Film Week. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Hope you're having a very good start to your Memorial Day weekend. We'll try and find an excellent film for you to see over the course of these 3 days. We start with Disney's live-action Aladdin, a remake of the 1992 animated film. Will Smith starring as the genie, Guy Ritchie directing the movie, and Aladdin and Princess Jasmine talk in the on the palace balcony in this clip from the film.
You should see these places. I mean, there's a whole world outside of books and maps. Do you want to?
How? Every door is guarded.
Who said anything about a door?
What are you doing?
Sometimes, princess, sometimes you just have to take a risk.
Aladdin's not only directed by Guy Ritchie, he co-wrote the screenplay with John August. What did you think, Christy?
So this is the latest in the many, many Disney live-action redos of their classic animated beloved films. It's fine. You know, it's fun. It's nice. The leads are both beautiful. Mina Massoud as Aladdin and Naomi Scott as Princess Jasmine. They have lovely chemistry. They're both beautiful to look at. It's funny. This time, the guy in the equation is the one that has the Disney princess eyes. They're magical. They're like almond-shaped. You could dive into them. And you know, it's a big spectacle. And given this is a Guy Ritchie film, which would seem like kind of a weird fit for that kind of material, he dials down a lot of the big, frantic, CGI-heavy style that has been his trademark of late in films like the Sherlock Holmes movies and King Arthur. It's a very straightforward kind of big spectacle musical. Will Smith is now your genie, filling in for Robin Williams' shoes.
It's tough shoes to
fill. Hard thing to do, right. But he brings his own kind of Will Smith swagger to it. And when the trailer first came out for this, I thought, ooh, this looks really weird. Like Will Smith as a giant blue genie. I'm not sure. Just there's something with the CGI that looked strange. And then as you see him in the role, it's a great fit for him. It's a chance for him to just show off his personality and his quick wit. It is fine.
Peter?
Well, or less than fine. I don't know. First of all, I'm a little dubious about this whole remaking Disney animated classics as live action things. I don't think, you know, with the possible exception of Cinderella, that any of them have been all that hot. Lion King is coming up next in July.
We have Beauty and the Beast.
Beauty and the Beast. You know, I mean, it really kind of I don't know why they need to do it except for the obvious commercial reason. This film, Guy Ritchie, what made them think that he would do a children's film and a musical to, you know, the director of Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels? He can't stage musical numbers, so they all look sort of like cloddy Bollywood stuff. And the two leads, yes, they're beautiful, but they also seem – they're about as flavorless and squeaky clean as holograms. They seem to be part of the CGI landscape, which is also pretty cheesy. And Will Smith, I know that he was trying to – be like not Robin Williams, you know, how could he? So he's but I think he overcorrected, and he's a little too sedate almost in this role for what is called for is this giant blue genie with a top knot. And, you know, I mean, but the whole thing seems very lackluster. Even the magic carpet looks kind of bummed out. So I didn't, you know, and the score is pretty much the same as the Alan Menken, but there's a new song called Speechless, which is unexciting. I think if you have kids and they're sort of in their pre-taste period, I think that they'll probably go for it.
My kid has taste, and I brought him, and he thought that they dispatched with the villain too quickly. That was his complaint.
I'm sure he likes just about everything, right? I mean,
he's seen Dunkirk. My kid's cultured. But however,
look who his mother is.
But Peter has a good point about how the whole carpet ride, that big A Whole New World production number, is like the signature song in the film, and it feels kind of empty and kind of rushed and doesn't really ever achieve the emotional swell that it seeks, and so it's a problem.
On the music, how were the vocal performances, and were the instrumentals somehow updated from the animated or in a similar sort of style as the original?
It feels very similar. The two of them both have a very classic, traditional kind of Broadway musical tone to their voice. They both belt out where you expect them to, and they have vibrato where you expect them to, and there's a wholesome kind of winningness to the delivery of the lyrics. And again, fine. It's what you expect from these kinds of roles. But Naomi Scott, who plays Jasmine, is lovely and has tremendous presence and charisma. I think this might make her a big star. She's also going to be in the Elizabeth Banks Charlie's Angels redo.
Whoa.
I wonder if they'll be singing.
Another. Yeah, right.
All right. Aladdin, live action version starring Will Smith, Mina Massoud, and Naomi Scott. Guy Ritchie directed and co-wrote it, rated PG in wide release. Booksmart is the directorial debut of Olivia Wilde. The story is about two best friends and academic superstars who decide to cram 4 years of fun into the eve of their high school graduation.
We have to go to a party tonight.
What?
Nobody knows that we are fun. We didn't party because we wanted to focus on school and get into good colleges.
And it worked.
But the irresponsible people who partied also got into those colleges. We haven't done anything. We haven't broken any rules.
Kate LeDever, Beanie Feldstein star in the film, as we mentioned, Olivia Wilde, directs in her feature debut. Four credited writers. Christy?
I love this movie. This is one of the best movies of the year. This will be on my top 10 list at the end of the year. It blew me away. Olivia Wilde achieves so much so beautifully here with the balance and tone that she finds, because it's a really raunchy R-rated movie. It'd be easy to summarize it as a female version of Superbad, and it's really a lot more than that. I mean, it's these two best friends, and they had this crazy night together, but they're both so beautifully drawn. And the two actresses lived together for 2.5 months during the filming of all of that, and that bonding really shows. And it's raunchy and really inappropriate and kind of gross at times, but there's such heart and there's such sweetness and there's such honesty about high school. And even the supporting players are drawn really beautifully. Skylar Gisondo plays this kind of nerdy, striving weirdo who wants their approval. And then Billie Lourd, Carrie Fisher's daughter, is in it as also a kind of a colorful high school weirdo. But they don't feel like just types, like paper thin types. They absolutely get blended into the story of this long, crazy night. And you really come to care about these young women. They are distinct from each other and yet have a great connection together. I love this movie.
There are four screenwriters, as I mentioned, all women. Yep. Emily Halpern, Sarah Haskins, Susanna Fogel, and Catherine Silberman. Peter.
Yeah, it's a terrific movie. It's one of the best high school comedies I've seen in a long time. And it's one of the few films about female friendship in that generation that actually rings true and makes sense. You know, a lot of times it's just sort of it's on the page and you have to accept it and it's sort of bland and generic. But here there's just so much going on with these characters. You know, the Caitlin Dever character has come out as gay and she has a crush on this woman in the film and you know, I mean, there are all sorts of things in the movie that you would expect would be sort of highlighted or pronounced or, you know, identified in some startling way. But it's all rather matter of fact in this film, which I think is really interesting that, you know, maybe this is sort of a watershed in that sense that you no longer have to make all sorts of, you know, big promo for these things that it's just part of what goes on. And also, you know, I think it's very, the problem I have only is with the rating. I know it should have been rated R, but who is this movie made for? If there are high school students or even preteens who would really get a kick out of this movie, it seems like, you know, the rating may be a little prohibitive for those people and that there ought to be some way for people to see this film Who are prohibited by seeing it, you know.
Well, they're not prohibited. They can go with a parent or guardian.
Right.
It's just on their own. But isn't this problem like Superbad? A lot of these films that are sort of, you know, would have a natural teen audience are rated R.
Eighth grade
is the classic example.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but, you know, Beanie Feldstein is Jonah Hill's sister. So this is her version of Superbad.
And she's been a critic's favorite, so now she gets an even bigger role.
Yeah, she was great in Lady Bird as well. Speaking of R-rated comedies that younger people should see, yeah, I hope that parents do drop their kids off at the mall or wherever to go see this.
Some of them are. But also, I mean, it's a directorial debut for Olivia Wilde, who you know is a very good actress, but this is a remarkable directorial debut. It's not just a lot of funny set pieces and a good script and engaging actors. It's really well directed.
And paced really well, too. It moves so nicely. And it's shot really beautifully, too.
Booksmart, the movie we're talking about, directed by Olivia Wilde, Caitlin Dever, Beanie Feldstein starts, rated R in wide release. And John Horn on the Frame interviewed Olivia Wilde earlier this week about her directorial debut, Booksmart. You can hear that, kpcc.org/theframe, or link from our Film Week page. Next, the documentary on L.A.'s Laurel Canyon, Echo in the Canyon. Andrew Slater, the director, Peter.
Yeah, I really like this film. It's, you know, it looks at the Laurel Canyon scene primarily from 1964 to 1968. And it brings in, there are so many people in this film, so many voices that are interviewed, you know, David Crosby, Jackson Brown, you know, Ringo Starr, Tom Petty in his last interviews, Stephen Stills, and they all reminisce about what happened in that era. It's intercut with a 2015 tribute concert that Jacob Dylan, who's sort of the impresario of this film, did with Regina Spektor and Beck and others at the Orpheum Theater. But the most fascinating parts of this movie are just, you know, people jawboning about those years and all the infighting and ins and outs. You know, Michelle Phillips talking about her infidelities and how that, you know, that led to... you know, do what you want to do, and all these things that came out of that era. That in that time, it was sort of, someone in the movie mentions, it was sort of like Paris in the 20s for the folk rock scene. That people all lived very close to each other, and you know, if you had an idea for a music or you thought of something, you walked across the street and went to someone's living room and started talking to someone about it. And it just sounds, I mean, I know it's somewhat romanticized in the film. You don't hear a lot of the darker stuff. You know, Brian Wilson is in the film, but you don't hear much about the darkness of that. And because of the time frame, people like Joni Mitchell are not brought into it and so forth. But it's a really fascinating history.
Well, and this commingling of, you know, tremendous artistic fertility and sort of at times a chaotic behavior,
you know, yeah, right.
Side by side,
fueled.
Yeah. Christy. Yeah. So Andrew Slater used to be the president of Capitol Records, and he's a longtime music manager. He's managed like Don Henley and the Go-Go's and Jacob Dylan and the Wallflowers. So between the two of them, they have such clout that they were able to amass this incredible array of musicians to tell these stories. And because Jacob Dylan is their peer, because he's not like me asking questions, he gets a lot intimacy and honesty and some candid recollections. You realize, you know, you've heard these songs all a million times, but hearing them all in one place makes you realize how influential they were, how enduring they still are. And I'd learned
how
a lot.
How good the music
yeah,
still is.
Yeah, and I learned a lot about how all of these various artists influence each other, how, like, the Beatles influenced the Beach Boys, who in turn influenced the Beatles again. Like, I didn't realize that Pet Sounds influenced Sergeant Pepper.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of really cool stories in there. They might be trying to get their arms around too much here, because between the concert and the recording sessions and the interviews and just sitting around with Beck and Regina Spektor looking at albums, they also intercut footage from this Jacques Demy film called Model Shop,
right,
which featured a guy going to L.A. and living in Laurel Canyon.
Gary Lockwood from
right,
2001.
There you go. And the images are very evocative of that time, but that's like a whole other layer of stuff going on. And while it was inspiring to the filmmakers, it feels rather tangential from our perspective. It's
yeah,
like,
I agree.
What is going on with this stuff here? But
yeah,
it's worth seeing. And if you're going to go see it this weekend, They're going to have live performances at the Cinerama Dome after several showings of it all weekend long.
Wonderful. Wow. The Arclight in Hollywood Cinerama Dome.
Wow.
It's playing there. The film is also playing at the Landmark in West L.A. Andrew Slater, directing Echo in the Canyon, takes you back to the 1960s, L.A.'s Laurel Canyon, and all the tremendous musical artists that lived and worked there. Coming up, we'll hear about the horror sci-fi film Brightburn, starring Elizabeth Banks, and the Spanish documentary The Silence of Others about the Franco dictatorship. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. Back with more from Peter Rayner and Christy Lemire in 1 minute. Coming up later this hour on Film Week, John C. Reilly. The actor's been in so many great films. There's 1 year that he was in 3 of the 5 Best Picture nominations. Quite the career, and also very active stage career. He'll be with us to talk about a production at the Pasadena Playhouse that's just opened, Gather, Surprising Stories and Other Mischief. It's in the Carrie Hamilton Theater of the Pasadena Playhouse. But right now, on Film Week, joined by critics Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of the Breakfast All Day podcast, Peter Rayner, Christian Science Monitor film critic. The sci-fi horror film Brightburn stars Elizabeth Banks and Jackson A. Dunn. David Yarovevsky is the director. Brian Gunn and Mark Gunn are the screenwriters. Christy.
This is an interesting idea that I wish they had done more with. It's kind of a cross between a sci-fi horror movie and a superhero origin story. And it sort of suggests what might have happened if Superman had crashed down to Earth and been evil and not had the best intentions for the world when he came here. There's a couple played by Elizabeth Banks and David Denman living on a farm in Kansas are trying to have a baby, having a hard time conceiving. And then one day, magically, this thing crash lands into their yard. And what do you know? There's a baby boy inside. And so they raise him, and he seems sweet and normal until one day when he's around like 12 or 13, he isn't. All of a sudden, the thing that he landed in starts calling to him and pulsating from inside the barn with red flashing lights.
You're good at that.
Thanks.
This is a metaphor for adolescence.
It is. It's like his bar mitzvah, but he's evil. And so he changes and he gets his calling for what he's supposed to do. And who he is and what he's been sent here for isn't all that complicated. I wish there had been more complexity, more development to it. The kid who stars in it, Jackson A. Dunn, does a good job of balancing the sweet, innocent side of his character and then the quietly evil. And there is some startlingly gnarly graphic stuff that happens to people in this movie. But I like Elizabeth Banks as a horror queen. You know, I like it's an interesting, different choice for her. She can do everything. She's known for comedy. She's directing a lot now. But to see her in this kind of role, she brings some dramatic heft to what could have just been a shrieky, scared mom role. I'm mixed on it. As you hear, I am mixed on it.
Brightburn is the film. And even though there is a child in the movie, not for kids, rated R in wide release. The Silence of Others, Spanish documentary back to the Franco regime. It's directed by Robert Bejar and Almudena Caicedo. What do you think, Peter?
It's a powerful movie. It's it was filmed over 6 years, and in 1977 in Spain, after Franco's death, he'd been the dictator there for four decades. There was something called the amnesty law, which was set in motion that people were supposed to forget about all the injustices and tortures and horrors that went on during that era. And just, you know, so there were no trials, no punishments. And gradually over time, a grassroots movement began, you know, to say, no, that's not right. You know, so many of our family, so many of ourselves have suffered. And so many of the people who caused the suffering are still in high places that they wanted to prosecute, and that couldn't happen in Spain. So the movement shifted to Argentina, where there was an international suit
tribunal
where you could do this. And so there was a judge in Argentina who attempted to press the suits in Spain, not terribly effectively, it turns out. There's a torturer who is went by the name of Billy the Kid, who lives in an apartment complex, and the guy who, you know, was severely tortured by him, you know, looks up at the window and sees the sky, and they try to bring these people to justice. The only problem with the movie, it's not a fault of the film, is that you're hoping for, you know, some great resolution, some justice to be done at the end, and for the most part, it doesn't happen. There's one part to this film that I thought was tremendously heartbreaking. There was a whole period of time when women who were either, you know, single mothers or were on the wrong side of politics, they were when they gave birth, they were put anesthetized so that they didn't actually experience the birth, and then when they woke up, the doctor said that the baby died, but they didn't. The babies were taken away and put up for adoption, and the mothers didn't know this for a very long time until it came out that this was being done to political and quote moral undesirables over a period of many years. So it's, you know, thousands and thousands of mothers lost their children, you know, never to really be located again. And that was one of the parts of the grassroots movement that they were trying to get to the bottom of. So, and one of the mothers, you know, speaks very feelingly about what happened to her. So it's a powerful movie.
The Silence of Others, a Spanish documentary. It's unrated. Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. The horror thriller The Perfection stars Allison Williams, Logan Browning, and Steven Weber. Richard Shepard is the director and screenwriter with Eric Charmello and Nicole Snyder. Christy.
This movie is insane, and I totally dug it, and I almost don't want to talk about it. I almost want to just tell you, just go see it and just trust me on this. I will say what I can without ruining its many crazy delights. So Allison Williams plays this brilliant cello prodigy and was on this path to greatness, and then has to take a break from it for a while when her mom gets sick. A younger student at the same academy where she had studied is now the hot young thing, and their two paths collide and they go on vacation together and crazy things happen. And you think it's gotten as crazy as it's going to get. You think nothing more could possibly happen, and then it does. And then it does again. And it's kind of like Showgirls in the world of elite cellists. Now, if that does not sell you, I don't know what will.
Richard Shepard, any films of his that you can...
I am not familiar with him, but he did it up here.
All right.
And the two women are very different, and they have a really sexy kind of fun chemistry with each other. And there's some body horror stuff going on here and twists and turns.
Wow.
And it's crazy. It's on Netflix. So when you're done listening to the show, go watch it.
Allison Williams was also creepy in Get Out.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, there's like a deadpan kind of accessibility to her that's very unnerving, and I enjoyed it here very much.
The Perfection, Richard Shepard directs. It's unrated on Netflix, streaming now. The documentary Walking on Water about the artist Christo, directed by Andre M. Paunov. Peter?
Yeah, this is a fascinating movie. You know, Christo is world-renowned for a lot of his projects, including, you know, wrapping the Reichstag in fabric and the gates in Central Park in New York and the Pont Neuf, wrapping that all. You know, he's
done
big
project
on wrapping,
here in California.
Right,
too.
Running, you know, running fancies. He's done all sorts of things. This project, he wanted to have people experience walking on water, by putting these sort of hydrocarbon piers arranged in sort of near Lake Como in northern Italy. And it was such a popular installation for the, I think, 6 weeks that it was there that you know, like several million people showed up for this, and they didn't really weren't able to accommodate it. Christo is a real character. He's just incredibly eccentric and irascible, and you would never, ever want to work for him if you, after seeing this
he's
movie.
He's notoriously difficult.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, you know, he makes Otto Preminger look like, you know, a Buddhist monk. I mean, he's just really, really tough to work for, but the results are quite fascinating.
Yeah, they're beautiful things he does, yeah. Christy.
This movie is like the fire festival of art installations, because things don't really go all that well. There are great expectations and ambitions and plans for it to be beautiful and for everyone to enjoy it. And it goes wrong pretty fast. And yeah, watching Christo just freak out at people, he and his right-hand man, Vlad, they get into it constantly. And there's a whole running gag where like technology fails on him. It's almost like an Abbott and Costello like bumbling that goes on with him over and over again. There are some questions I have here as far as like logistics, you know, money, things like that. But it's beautiful.
Little things like that.
he's such a trip to just watch him. And then you see the genuine wonder and joy in his eyes when it all does come together. Very much worth watching.
Sort of reminds me of Gene Wilder, you know, when he would always have these explosions in his movies and suddenly lose it. I mean, Christo is constantly losing it. And the fact that he looks so much like Christopher Lloyd in Back to the Future helps.
Walking on Water, a documentary about the artist Christo, who does these large-scale installations at the New Art in West L.A. It's unrated. Running with Beto, a documentary about Beto O'Rourke, the presidential candidate from Texas. This, though, takes a look at his U.S. Senate race against incumbent Ted Cruz. Christy?
So this is a very intimate fly-on-the-wall documentary about Beto O'Rourke, and it really does capture what it is about him that appealed to so many people. His youthful exuberance, his accessibility. It's kind of like a feature film version of all those live streams he did of his life. But it's weird to watch it now through the prism of the current presidential politics in that, you know, all that excitement for him has waned a bit now that more probable candidates have entered the field, and so it feels like a bit of an anachronism time capsule, but it does give you a great sense of what makes him him.
Yeah, I thought it was sort of like a promotional video for his campaign more than anything else.
It's going to be streaming on HBO next week, but this weekend at Lemley's Monica Film Center, David Modigliani, the director of Running with Beto, it's unrated. And the romantic drama The Tomorrow Man stars John Lithgow and Blythe Danner. Christy?
John Lithgow and Blythe Danner deserve much, much better than this. He is a doomsday conspiracy theorist prepping for the end of the world. She is a hoarder. They fall in love in a small town in the Midwest. And they're lovely, you know, but their characters are ideas and the script is very wobbly.
Always worth seeing these two actors, but not necessarily in this movie.
The Tomorrow Man, rated PG-13 at the Landmark in West L.A. And Peter has the Ojai Music Festival coming up June 6th through the 8th. And film is a part of the festival. Peter, what's on tap?
Yeah, it's actually 6th through the 9th. There's a lot of you know, great stuff going on there, but the film aspect of it is good. There's a return of something called Ojai Films, which is going to be at the Ojai Presbyterian Church. They're showing several documentaries by the French actor Mathieu Almaric, who you may recognize as the bad guy in Quantum of Solace and other films, Diving Bell and other movies. He directed some films about the composer instrumentalist John Zorn, who's a saxophonist and everything else. I mean, he's an incredible musician. He won't be there, but there are two films about him that, you know, are going to be really extraordinary because of the extraordinariness of his career. Barbara Hannigan, who's the music director this year, is staging a production of Stravinsky's Rake's Progress. And there's two short films about her that are also directed by Almaric. And also something in connection with Crazy Girl Crazy, which is the Gershwin tribute that she's staging with her group for the end of the festival. It's you know, this is a festival that was started by, you know, Aaron Copland, you know, Stravinsky, Pierre Boulez, Salonen. All of these notables, Peter Sellers, have all been festival directors at this festival.
At an extraordinary location.
Yeah, it's an incredible location outdoors in Libby Park. And it's really a wonderful way to commune with nature and hear all these, you know, wonderful. They're going to be staging Stravinsky's Rake's Progress on the 9th. So it's really extraordinary. And to bring movies into it, I think, is doubly exciting.
One of our true local gems, great artistic event, the Ojai Music Festival, June 6th through 9th. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. Peter Rayner, Christy Lemire with us. Coming up, John C. Reilly. You've seen him in so many great films, but he also a noted stage actor. We'll talk about his new Southern California production opening this weekend. Remember that Emotions tune from the soundtrack of Boogie Nights? John C. Reilly, an important part of that great ensemble cast. John C. Reilly made his first appearance on screen in Brian De Palma's Casualties of War. But I really took note of his work with his starring role in Paul Thomas Anderson's Heartache. It was a poignant performance as a down-and-out young man who's taken under the wing of a professional gambler played by the great Philip Baker Hall. Well, the following year, Reilly co-starred in Anderson's Boogie Nights. Then it was Terrence Malick's The Thin Red Line, Magnolia, The Perfect Storm, A Prairie Home Companion, Chicago, Walk Hard, The Dewey Cox Story, Wreck-It Ralph, and most recently Stan and Ollie. Reilly isn't only a versatile actor. He performs in a wide array of venues, including Broadway and regional theater. His latest project is at the Pasadena Playhouse's Carrie Hamilton Theater, Gather, Surprising Stories and Other Mischief. John C. Reilly, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Larry. It's an honor to be here with you. I listen to you a lot.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I see you at virtually everything you do. So this is a pleasure. So tell us about the show. What is the theme of the show you're doing?
Well, it's called Gather, Surprising Stories and Other Mischief, as you mentioned, and we're doing it at the Pasadena Playhouse. It is an evening of story theater, and it's something that I've been trying to do with my mentor and good friend Patrick Murphy for many, many years. Paul Sills, who started the Second City Theater in Chicago, whose mother was Viola Spolin, the mother of improvisational acting in America. She literally wrote the book on it. Anyway, Paul Sills developed this type of theater that where the actors are, you stage it in kind of an improvisational way. The actors both play characters and the narration of the story at the same time. So it's once you see it, it'll be real clear. But anyway, Paul Sills' production of Story Theater won a Tony on Broadway when he did it in the 1970s. And it has become kind of soaked into the groundwater of theater, this way of telling stories. A lot of it is done with space work and space objects, you know, making the invisible visible, and a lot of transformational kind of acting where people transform into different creatures and people. And in a simple way, it's the way kids tell stories, you know. So this is our version of that, our version of story theater. And we've taken stories from Grimm's fairy tales and old folk tales and all these kind of oral tradition stories that have been passed down for years and years. We're bringing them to life before your very eyes, myself and an ensemble of actors. And, you know, it's my way of sort of giving back to the community here in Pasadena. And we called the show Gather because that's what the spirit of it is. You know, in these times of, you know, strife and a lot of division amongst people and various bad news in the world, I think the reason or the answer to all of that is to gather together, come together and share a human experience and connection with each other. So that's what we're trying to do.
It sounds great. John C. Reilly with us on Air Talk. So it sounds like it has its roots in improvisation to some degree. So is every performance somewhat unique?
Well, it's staged in an improvisational way, and for a month before we started even rehearsing the show, we worked together in an improvisational workshop. Patrick Murphy taught, who's directing the play, taught theater for 30 years, or acting for 30 years at the DePaul Theater School in Chicago.
Where you were,
where,
right?
I went, and that's where Rick Murphy and I met all these years ago. And we've been talking about wanting to do a story theater thing together for a long time. So Danny Feldman, the great new artistic director of the Pasadena Playhouse, said that they had a vacancy at the Carrie Hamilton Theater. It's this little 99-seat theater upstairs, very intimate space.
It's nice space.
Yeah, black box. I mean, the Pasadena Playhouse itself is an extraordinary place if you haven't been. It's the State Theater of California. It is a historic Spanish building from 1919, I think. Anyway, it's a really special place just to be. But Danny Feldman, the artistic director there, said, we've got this opening. And I said, well, I've got this idea. And here we are just a few months later. We're putting up the show. This Friday it opens, May 24th, which is incidentally my birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. So I can't think of a better way to celebrate than to bring people together in community and tell stories and surprise them and scare them and make them laugh and do all the wonderful, magical things that theater can do in its most simple form.
We're talking about the month-long run at the Hamilton Theater at the Pasadena Playhouse of Gather, Surprising Stories, and Other Mischief. John C. Reilly starring in the production that also includes Lysia Adams, Larry Bates, Michael Dunn, Amy Farrell, Mary Grill, Max Kleinman, Chris Schultz, and Madeline Wager, all in the cast of that production. And I'm assuming this is an all-ages show?
Well, some of the stories, as you might know from Grimm's
Fairy
Tales.
Are these really Grimm's Fairy Tales?
Exactly. Some of them are pretty intense.
Okay.
And we wanted to do not just, you know, things that people could easily dismiss as, oh, that's just a fairy tale or kiddie stuff. We wanted to get into some of the darker aspects of the storytelling. So there are a couple stories that might be best for people 8 years old and older. We're saying our age group is 8 to 800.
Okay.
So we're hoping all kinds of people in that age range come. However, we are going to do towards the end of the run a couple matinees that are all ages, where we'll slightly edit some of the stories so that they're digestible for the little ones. But yeah, that's the beautiful thing about these stories is, like, just as soon as you think, like, well, this one's a little too cute for adults, all the adults are crying and are so moved by it. Or as soon as you say, well, this might be too scary for kids, the kids are like on the edge of their seat and loving it. So I don't know. Rick Murphy was my first acting teacher in college, and he's the one. He taught Spolin technique of improvisation his whole career, and he's the one who introduced that work to me. So it's like coming full circle with it.
And how does that inform your acting, John C. Reilly, with us on KPCC? How did those things that you studied when you were in school, you still bring those consciously in some ways to your work?
Absolutely. You know, film especially requires a lot of improvisation because you have a template that you're working with, a script, and then you get there and you're like, well, what does this moment really hold? You know, it can't just be the script. We have to discover what we have right here in this room, not what we plan to have, but what we actually have. So improvisation is the backbone of what I do. I mean, there's some films that I've done, like Boogie Nights, for instance. There's whole scenes in Boogie Nights that are completely improvised. There's whole scenes in Step Brothers that are completely improvised. So it's always been something that I do. It's an amazing thing what Viola Spolin did. She taught a children's theater workshop in Hollywood, of all places, I think starting in the 1940s. And she was trying to figure out a way to reach kids in the place where they naturally are with their imaginations. So she came up with these games. You know, she thought, well, they love to play duck, duck, goose. Let's play duck, duck, goose. And then she sort of expanded games from there that would encourage free thinking and expression in actors. And then it quickly transferred from this children's workshop she was doing into all age groups of actors, because every actor is what you get from improvisation is you get the feeling like, I don't need a prop man or a costumer or a lighting designer or a director. If I can create a glass of water, like I'm doing right now for you, then I can literally create anything I can think of, anything that comes to me. I can transform myself into anything. And it's all done through, you know, these games that are taught through the Spolin method. She was a really important person to me. And Patrick Murphy certainly was my mentor. And now he's like my best friend after all these years. But
and you're collaborating on this project, Gather, Surprising Stories and Other Mischief. And I have to think that ability to improvise in the moment, bring your creativity to bear on a character, also builds confidence as a performer. We'll come back and pick it up from there. You're listening to John C. Reilly, Oscar-nominated performer, Tony Award nominee for True West, the great Sam Shepard production. We'll continue our conversation with him about Gather, Surprising Stories, and Other Mischief at the Pasadena Playhouse's Carrie Hamilton Theater. You're listening to 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle joining you with John C. Reilly, the noted actors in so many great films. I think 1 year of the five nominees, he was in three of them or something like that. It's incredible. Yeah. Incredible
it's a
run. It's got to be a record. Who else is in 60% of the best film nominees? But he's been in so many great films, working with the best directors, Paul Thomas Anderson, working with Robert Altman, so many great people with whom he has collaborated. Critically acclaimed for Stan and Ollie, a film that came out late last year, for his performance as Oliver Hardy, and musical talent as well, with a critical role in Chicago as Roxy Hart's husband in that film, and Dewey Cox as well, the rocker film. We're talking with him, though, about a new production, the Pasadena Playhouse's Carrie Hamilton Theater, which is opening Friday, May 24th, Gather, Surprising Stories, and Other Mischief. We're just talking about the importance of improv, because this production comes out of some of the principles of improv as the production is crafted. And John was saying that in Boogie Nights, that great film, that much of that dialogue was improvised. Now, I don't know that that's the case with this, but let's listen to Reed Rothschild, his character, the porn star, in conversation from Boogie Nights.
Hey, did you ever see that movie Star Wars?
Oh, about four times.
People tell me I look like Han Solo.
Really?
What do you bench?
You tell first.
I asked you first.
Same time.
Cool.
Are you ready?
Ready.
One, two, three. You didn't say anything.
Oh, neither did you.
From Boogie Nights. Was that improvised?
That was scripted by the great Paul Thomas Anderson. But yeah, he used to just let us cut loose. He said, well, You sort of put stage directions, like they try to get their tapes back from the studio manager, and that was it. And we would just do everything anything that came into our heads. But it's a great way. It's a great freedom to have when you're working as an actor, because especially in film, who cares? You know, just use a different take.
Yeah,
if
I was
going to
say,
like,
just do it again.
Yeah. So not every actor can do it. Not everyone has that kind of confidence, but when you do work with people that can cut loose like that, why not?
Yeah. By the way, we're going to be showing our next Film Week screening series, Boogie Nights, Theater at Ace Hotel, the classic Movie Palace, downtown Los Angeles. You can get tickets for the Saturday, July 27th screening.
June.
I'm sorry. By visiting kpcc.org/in-person. Hope you come out for that. John, I wanted to ask you about working for different highly talented directors and sort of the strengths or things that you maybe with some directors have to work around. Robert Altman, with whom you did Prairie Home Companion, mm-hmm. what are the things that you felt he did particularly well that you appreciated working with him on that?
Well, it's funny that we segue from improvisation into talking about Robert Altman, because Robert Altman was one of the great directors who embraced improvisation that I worked with, and from his films you can really see that the actors in his films just feel like they own the characters, you know. And I remember talking with Bob before I did Prairie Home Companion. I thought, well, I play a singing cowboy in that movie. Are they real cowboys, or are they cowboy performers, or what? You know, and he's like, listen, just show up here and it'll all fall into place. You'll understand what I want to do. And Bob, one of his greatest expressions, he had many expressions. The last thing he said to me, actually, as he was getting into a car before he passed away, was, "See you in the next reel," which I loved. That was one of his favorite phrases. And then another one that he had was, just giggle and give in. And I think that kind of encapsulated his sort of worldview. But on Prairie Home Companion, yeah, it was this amazing ensemble of people who were all practically living in that Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota, where Prairie Home was broadcast for so many years. It was just so much fun, you know. You felt like you were part of a community. And it's interesting coming in here today to talk about this theater piece at the Pasadena Playhouse. And to reference that kind of experience, because that was very much in the spirit of what I'm doing with this show right now, like just encourage an ensemble of people to come together and to really unleash their imaginations and create something from thin air. And then do it in front of people,
yeah.
You know, that
with no net.
It's
yes.
a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. I have to say,
it's gotta be.
And if you like the music stuff that I've done, you know, I've come into KPCC in the past and played music with my band, John Riley and friends, Tom Brousseau and Becky Stark. In this show in Gather, I play folk songs in and out of the different stories. It's the way we kind of thread the string of pearls of the stories is with music. And that's similar to what Paul Sills did with his original Story Theater production so many years ago, was use folk music to kind of, you know, because all old stories in a way are like old songs. You know, I use a couple of Robert Burns poems in the show that are songs. And in a pre-literate age, like when Robert Burns was writing all these amazing, he's a great Scottish poet, in case you don't know. But every time he would write a poem, he would give it a melody so that people who didn't know how to read could remember the poem. And I think that's such a beautiful sentiment.
Yeah.
And that's the ancient origin of stories and of poetry and of music, is a way to pass things along. Melody that you cannot forget, you know, and a lot of the songs that I use in this show, Gather, are songs like that. You hear them one time and you can never forget them. These songs that you hear them one time and you think, like, what is it about that song? What is it about that collection of notes that seems to be eternal?
Yeah.
You know, why is it that the Grimm's brothers put these stories down? How did these stories survive for those thousands of years to that point in the 1800s when these two German brothers wrote them down? I think it's because of this oral tradition and this unending compulsion that people have to get together in the dark and tell each other stories. And I think that's, you know, I really try to encourage empathy in a lot of the work that I do. It's one of my most important one of the most important qualities I try to bring to my work, whether it's Wreck-It Ralph or whether it's Step Brothers or whether it's, you know, a theater piece.
That's not going to surprise anybody who's seen your performances.
Well, because it is really important to me. And I think in this jam that we're in with all the terrible news that just floods into us every day, it can get very discouraging. And I think the only way out of it, to me, is through empathy, is through connecting with people, regardless of their background or their politics or their gender, and just say, you know what, we're both human beings. Let's share something together. We have a lot in common.
It's a perfect way for us to end our conversation. John C. Riley, thank you so much for coming in and joining us today.
My
we
pleasure,
really
Larry.
Appreciate it.
And thank you for being such an important part of the L.A. community. You really do bring people together with your show, and I appreciate it every day.
Thank you. That means a lot. John C. Riley, the gifted actor, whether it's on stage or on film. He is on stage. The Pasadena Playhouse's Carrie Hamilton Theater, Friday, May 24th through late June. The performance of Gather, Surprising Stories, and Other Mischief. You can get your tickets by visiting the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We've got a link for you to get your tickets. And, of course, a reminder, Boogie Nights, which John C. Riley had a co-starring role in that film. Our next Film Week screening tickets available, kpecc.org/in-person. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.